When a British Greek scholar named George Derwent Thompson rowed 2 miles off the west coast of Ireland to Great Blasket Island in 1923, he found a population of just over 150 who spoke a refined form of Gaelic, but no English. Great Blasket is the largest of a group of 7 small islands off the west coast of County Kerry. It had likely been inhabited for close to 2 centuries prior to Thompson's arrival, although its residents had little interaction with the mainland. Robert Cannigal recalls the history of Great Blasket through the narratives of scholars and writers who fell in love with its beauty and with its people in a book called On an Irish Island, which is published by Knopf. And I'm very pleased to welcome Mr. Cannigal to our show today. Hello.
Hello.
George Derwent Thompson is a fascinating character in a number of different ways. He was a prominent figure in the British Communist Party, who applied Marxist thought to Greek studies. Did you come across him first or the story of Great Blasket Island?
No, I came across the story of the island first. It's important in thinking about Thompson to keep in mind chronology. He became a Marxist much later.
In the 30s.
And he went to the island in 1923.
Now, why was he even rowing across this 2 miles of this bay to go to Great Blasket?
He was a student at King's College, Cambridge. And he was a student of the classics. He said later that if he'd had the choice, that he would have been a Celtic studies scholar, except that there was no Celtic studies at the time. He had become entranced by the story, the romantic story, of an Ireland pulling itself out from the English yoke earlier on. He had been more interested in that story than in World War I, which was going on at the same time. And he wanted to hear Irish. He wanted to hear pure spoken Irish.
So he heard that there were people who spoke pure Irish on this island?
Mm-hmm.
What was life like on that island? Did they have much interaction with people on the mainland?
This was an island that had seemingly nothing. It had no plumbing, no electricity, no priests, no pubs, no trees. It was a very simple life that the people lived there. They survived from fishing and farming. And what they had,
lived
though—
Lived in stone houses.
They lived in stone houses facing the mainland about 3 miles away. But what they had, what all the visitors who went to the Blasket remarked on, is this sort of double quality that beside all the hardship, there was a very vibrant culture built around face-to-face, one-to-one relationships with singing and dancing and storytelling, and it was really entrancing for young George.
But how did they get supplies? Did they go across the bay, or you say shipwrecks supply the islanders with goods?
It was late in coming as an idea, but when you think of the crops of the Great Blasket, it would be fish and potatoes and refuse coming up onto the shore. It happened relatively frequently, and people, what would happen is there would be a shipwreck, and it happened most obviously during war, and people would go down to the shore and collect what they could find.
Did that isolation, is that one of the reasons that they continue to speak in this rather refined version of Gaelic?
The isolation is, in a sense, what saved them. Irish had been We call it Gaelic. They call it Irish, the language. Irish had been spoken by most Irish people years before, and then the English came, and the English succeeded in pushing Irish over to the West, so that English began to take over a larger and larger proportion of Ireland, so that they were left enclaves of Irish-speaking areas in Connemara and Donegal and in Kerry. And the purest, in a sense, because it was least contaminated, least tainted by English, was this island off the coast of Kerry.
Because these people were not bilingual.
They were not bilingual.
And so it was pure. It was rather refined, but they were largely illiterate, weren't they?
Yeah, which brings up the next question. They were largely illiterate, which brings up the next question, that out of this island came a series of memoirs and autobiographies stimulated by the visitors who went to the island. And the next logical question is, how could that possibly be if they were illiterate? And the fact is that there were a few people who spoke Irish, who wrote and read Irish. And probably the first was a man named Thomas O'Cridden, who learned Irish with idiosyncrasies of spelling at around the age 40.
And they were using Roman letters, although all those little attachments.
It turns out that during the play of this story, which is basically in the teens, 20s, and 30s, the orthodox orthography of Irish was changing. So if you look at some of the early letters, they look different, early correspondence, they look different from later correspondence.
But I would assume that that there was, because it was such a strong storytelling tradition here, it was all oral, which
it was completely
has, a,
oral.
Has a very different, affects the use of the language in a very different way.
Mm-hmm. The same George Thompson remarked that one of the miracles of what happened on the island during this period is that the books that came out of the Blasket exactly coincided with the switchover from a purely oral culture to a literate culture.
Hasn't Gaelic been described as a rather difficult language to learn?
It's impossibly difficult.
What makes it so difficult?
I took a very, very brief intercession course in Irish, and it was daunting to me, and I felt a little guilty about it. You know, why is it so hard? And then I talked to other people who had studied other Celtic languages, other languages in general, people who had an ear for language, and they all agreed that, that there was something peculiarly difficult about Irish.
And what is it? Is it structured differently than other Western
languages? There are differences in structure, and there are differences in words actually change not only the form on the printed page, but in the way they sound, depending on the way they're used in speech.
Although that happens in Chinese as well, where there are tones, and if you don't sing the words mm-hmm. correctly, people don't understand what you're saying. A listener asked why the Irish haven't been able to resurrect Gaelic as Hebrew has been resurrected in Israel.
From what I've heard, it's a very good question, because what I've heard is that Hebrew is the sole language around the world that was on the edge of disappearance, that has been successfully brought back into common usage. That has not happened in Ireland, although there have been periodic attempts by the Irish government all through since the establishment of the state to do so, requiring that certain jobs, the job holders, have a competence in Irish and so on.
But we do see it in Wales, where the signage is all in Welsh and parts of Scotland. You see it in the Navajo territory of the United States.
In the areas of Western Ireland that are Irish-speaking, these very narrow, limited areas are called collectively the Gaeltacht. And the signs are in Irish, there's no question. But that doesn't automatically mean that the ordinary people in ordinary speech speak Irish. In the particular areas of the mainland facing the Blasket where I visited and where is located the Blasket Center, people do speak Irish. But these are small enclaves.
My guest is Robert Kanigel, K-A-N-I-G-E-L, the award-winning author of 6 previous books. His book, The Man Who Knew Infinity, was a finalist for the National Book Critics Circle Award. His latest is On an Irish Island, and it's about Great Blasket Island, which these days is not inhabited anymore. So is this the kind of situation that we have seen with tribes that were that had remained isolated in the Amazon, for example, until anthropologists came in and then were changed forever?
I don't know if we can make quite that kind of a likeness. What we can say is that this is a story repeated all over the world. In many ways, in one sense, my book is about an island and the people who live there and the people who visited it and their interactions. In another sense, it's about the tension between older traditional societies, village societies, and the modern world. And this is a book basically about people superbly educated scholars from places like Paris and London and Oslo who went across the Irish Sea to Ireland and then across Ireland and went to this island. And there was this tension between the world that they represented and this traditional world.
Well, you tell the story through the experiences of four scholars. How were they received? Robin Flower, George Thompson, and the others. Didn't they? Some of them develop long-lasting relationships with the islanders.
They did, to a man and to a woman. The scholars that I'm writing about, they're linguists and writers, were affected for the rest of their lives by their experiences on the island. They had left their old world behind. They came onto this island and they found something completely new. In some cases, they fell in love with people on the island. They made fast friendships that influenced their entire lives.
And they fell in love with the can we call it literature, at least the myths and the traditions here, and brought them back to the rest of the world. Did it have a real impact on the flowering of Irish literature at this time?
Certainly it did.
Do we see it in Joyce? Do we see it in O'Casey and people like that?
This is nonfiction. This is one of the interesting aspects of this literature is it's an autobiographical literature. It's not fiction. It's not plays. These are long memoirs about life written by the people who lived it that come out and have affected literature, in a sense creating a new genre. The Irish language memoir. Yes, they've been translated into English and many other languages. The 20 Years of Growing by Maurice O'Sullivan was actually a Book of the Month Club book in English in the 1930s.
In the early 19th century, Ireland's population was 8 million. By 1926, fewer than 4 million remained, half, and the country's rural west was particularly decimated. Along with those from the mainland, did the islanders also come to the United States?
It's a sad story. The population of the island was about 200 around the time of World War I. Gradually, it dropped during the 1920s and 1930s. The fact is,
people
looking
life?
For opportunity, people looking for the modern world, people looking for comfort. And lives that weren't so hard. It's easy to romanticize the life of the island, but the fact is it was brutally hard. It was hard to make a living. It was dangerous. People drowned. People fell off the cliffs and died. And the visitors that I write about who went to the island typically, not invariably, but typically went during the warmer weather. And the islanders were on the island all year round. The winds are blowing. It's cold. It's vicious out there. And it seems to be fairly natural that people are attracted to an easier life.
So you'd assume that they just would have gone to Ireland. But some of them did come here.
Most of them came here.
Springfield, Massachusetts?
Yeah,
why
yeah.
there?
I have tried to find out, and I have failed. How the first Blasketer wound up in Springfield, Massachusetts, I do not know, and other people have looked also. But the fact is that once there was a contingent of Blasketers there, and other people from West Kerry, that was the place for a Blasketer to go.
Are they still speaking Irish there?
In Springfield?
Springfield.
No. But they have a warm feeling, a warm association for their forebears who came over, and they all feel like they have a linkage and identity with the Blasket Island of their parents.
By 1953, there were only 21 people remaining on the island, but they were forced to leave. Why?
What happened is that in, I guess it was 1947, a young man got sick. And typically, there were no medical facilities on the island, no doctors, no nurse. Typically, what you do is get them over to the mainland, get them some care, and it wasn't so easy. The weather was horrendous, and they couldn't get across Blasket Sound. And day after day, he got worse, and it turned out that it was 3 weeks before they could get to the mainland, and he died in the interim of spinal meningitis. And at that point, the central government in Dublin, or shortly thereafter, decreed the abandonment of the island.
And did the islanders leave willingly?
What is willingly?
Because they didn't go back.
Yeah. What is willingly? So many of the islanders said things like, I was happy there. I was happy on the island. And yet they left anyway. There is this peculiar tension, I think, that the people all felt, and a tension that runs through my book on something beautiful and attractive there, and at the same time untenable.
But also of historical significance. There are we've discovered prehistoric settlements as well. I don't know whether the
people that long predated the Blasket settlements.
But were they even aware of them?
I don't know.
No, but are people going there now? Has it become a tourist destination?
It's a little.
Is there a McDonald's near?
There's no McDonald's. There are no hotels. There are no hostels. There's no bed and breakfast. It's still kind of hard to get over there. You get over in a motor launch, and then you have to transfer it to a little rubber dinghy that takes you onto the shore.
Are all the other islands also no longer inhabited?
You mean the Lesser Blaskets?
Yes.
It's called the Great Blasket because there are six other small islands. Mostly they were never inhabited.
And is the Irish language taught today in Ireland?
The Irish language is taught.
So it was kept alive to some degree because of the Blasket Islands.
I don't think that it's fair to say that, to say that the Blasket Islands kept the language going. There are all sorts of competing forces in Ireland. Some people are completely oblivious and don't want to be bothered by anything that they're getting about Irish in school. And for some people, it's a treasure. It's part of the Irish heritage that it's important to preserve.
And I've spoken to a number of Irish writers who've told me that it's there in the back of their minds when they're writing English, that it has colored the way the Irish writers write English.
Well, one of the delights of writing this book is it sent me into directions that I wasn't used to. I had not read J.M. Singh, and I did read it as part of this, and he brought this wonderful combination of English and Irish into his plays.
What a great playwright. Robert Canigal's book, On an Irish Island, is published by Knopf. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.